Lincoln and the Bardo, the debut novel by the prize-winning short story writer George Saunders, finally took form after circulating in his mind for some 20 years.
Circulating and being pushed down, I really resisted it, mostly because I just couldn't think of a way to do it that wasn't kind of ham-handed. You have an idea about a story, you start to write it. At some point, it gets angry with you for having such a low vision of it. It wants you to see the bigger version of it, and it kind of will cross its arms and hold its breath until you see it for what it is. When my story gets locked up, I know it's because I've had too low an opinion of it, and now it wants its time to tell me what it's about.
Peek into the creative process of George Saunders as he discusses Lincoln and the Bardo, winner of Britain's Man Booker Prize for Best Novel Written in English in 2017, on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with the acclaimed American writer of short stories, essays, and children's books when he visited the Kansas City Public Library. We have a previous show about his early days, so we focused on this unusual story involving Abraham Lincoln, his third son Willie, and a cast of supporting characters living and dead that novelist Colson Whitehead described as a luminous feat of generosity and humanism. Here's George Saunders to talk about how Lincoln and the Bardo came to be.
I'll often do this thing where if I think of an idea, it's almost like a ventriloquist. I'll throw a voice out, like, okay, how would it sound? Maybe it would sound like this. And if that voice isn't intriguing or fun, then I just know better. And whenever I would think about the Lincoln book, you know, you'd think like kind of Gore Vidal light, you know, that Lincoln came into the frosty great. And so it seemed like theoretically a good idea. But when I actually went to do it, I could never get any of the prose to stick.
Well, and there have been so many books about Lincoln.
Over 30,000, I believe.
That is a whole bunch.
So that became part of it, was to say, look, I'm not writing a book about Lincoln because, one, I don't have time to really know him. And, two, it's been done from every angle. So I'm using him in a dramatic contrivance, basically. So that, just as a psychological trick, it was good because it took the pressure off. He wasn't the mainstay of the book. He was just a guy who wandered through it.
Though an important character in the book,
yeah,
because all the other characters are revolving around him. Let's talk a little bit about how you structured Lincoln and the Bardo, because it's really fascinating how you have this ghost world. Maybe I should have you set
up
the book for
us. Well,
it's
just a story of a night in February 1862 when, and I think this is historically indicated, Lincoln was so heartsick about the loss of his son Willie that he actually entered the crypt. And the newspaper said on several occasions, so I don't know whether that means in successive days, we don't know. So that's what I heard 20 years ago and was intrigued by it. When I look back on it, I can see that my subconscious was doing something systematic to lead me to this book, but it didn't look systematic. So I had a play I tried to write on this subject, and I had another book set in a graveyard that had nothing to do with Lincoln and so on. And I often find that artistic problems, they kind of proceed along four or five parallel tracks. You don't even recognize it. And then only when the book is done, you can kind of look back and go, oh, look, all those things were pushing me, you know.
Well, I thought I would have you read this. It's chapter 21.
Sure.
This is in the voice of Willie Lincoln, the son of Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, so this is the first time that Lincoln comes into the crypt, and he's holding the physical body while the ghostly body of Willie is kind of hovering, and this is in his voice. So the Bardo of the title is a Tibetan word meaning transitional zone. So there are several of them. We're in one right now, the transition between birth and death. But the Bardo of the book is the one that starts at the moment of your death, and it goes to whatever comes next, whether it's heaven or hell or reincarnation. So in that tradition, in the Bardo tradition, sometimes when a spirit leaves the body, it can actually look back or look down and see the body, and it sees it as a hideous thing, like a worm or a reptile or something really terrifying, because it's so coarsely physical and the spirit is something so much purer. So here, Willie is watching his father hold his physical body. Mouth at the worm's ear, father said, "We have loved each other well, dear Willie, but now, for reasons we cannot understand, that bond has been broken. But our bond can never be broken. As long as I live, you will always be with me, child." And then let out a sob. Dear father crying, that was hard to see. And no matter how I patted and kissed and made to console, it did know. "You were a joy," he said. "Please know that. Know that you were a joy to us. Every minute, every season, you did a good job. A good job of being a pleasure to know." Saying all this to the worm, How I wished him to say it to me and to feel his eyes on me. So I thought, all right, by Jim, I will get him to see me. And in I went. It was no bother at all. Say, it felt all right, like I somewhat belonged in there, held so tight. I was now partly also in Father and could know exactly what he was, could feel the way his long legs lay, how it is to have a beard, taste coffee in the mouth, and though not thinking in words exactly, knew that the feel of him in my arms has done me good. It has. Is this wrong? Unholy? No, no, he is mine. He is ours, and therefore I must be, in that sense, a God in this. Where he is concerned, I may decide what is best. And I believe this has done me good. I remember him, again, who he was. I had forgotten somewhat already. But here, his exact proportions, his suit smelling of him still, his forelock between my fingers, the heft of him familiar from when he would fall asleep in the parlor and I would carry him up to, it has done me good. I believe it has. It is secret, a bit of secret weakness that shores me up. In shoring me up, it makes it more likely that I shall do my duty in other matters. It hastens the end of this period of weakness. It harms no one. Therefore, it is not wrong, and I shall take away from here this resolve. I may return as often as I like, telling no one, accepting whatever help it may bring me, until it helps me no more. Then Father touched his head to mine. Dear boy, he said, I will come again. That is a promise.
That's from Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders. And of course, that's Abraham Lincoln who is in the crypt to see his son after his son has died from typhoid fever.
Yeah.
But the real building of character came with the whole ghost world that you created. How did you come up with that?
You know, my method of writing is really iterative. I do a lot of rewriting. And I also rely on the South Side of Chicago skill of impersonation. So when we were kids, that was one way you could get credibility, was to imitate a teacher or, you know, your parents. Or the highest thing you could do was make up a character and do a convincing voice, you know, and sustain it. I had to apply the discipline of keeping the geography of the graveyard really strong in my mind. What does it look like? Who's where? What time?
And was that based on the actual graveyard, or did you create the graveyard?
Both. I went there and I took meticulous notes, and then when I got home, I said, yeah, don't be constrained by that. Or again, it'll feel like a catalog, but mostly, certainly the feeling of that graveyard. It's a beautiful graveyard in Georgetown. But then it was just a matter of saying, okay, we're walking from point A to point B. There's 20 or 30 graves, anybody up, you know? And then for me, the whole trick is to not overthink it, not plan it, not do any kind of thematic preset. Just look around and a ghost is approaching and then just start riffing. Now, in some ways it sounds easy, but what you're really doing is you're just trying to keep your mind blank and see which voice your subconscious sends you. And the operating theory is you're so deep in the book that your subconscious is your best friend. It knows things you haven't quite figured out yet. So the way that that actually plays out is just sort of kind of a fun improv. And as you're doing it, kind of like a voice comes out. And as a voice comes out, circumstances emerge. They co-arise a little bit. And in this world, one of the helpful things was that in this particular kind of purgatorial space, there are no happy people. You know, everybody who's there is there because when they died, they weren't ready to go. So then you think, okay, what are some reasons people might not be ready to die? Love, greed, lust, hubris, you know. So that gave you a little bit of the first step of how to make somebody up. But it was interesting because then the trick became you have to make so many people, you have to make sure they don't step on each other, you know. So that becomes a little bit of a semantic game. You know, this guy has to use this density of ampersands. This person has this repetitive verbal trait. So it was kind of improv plus bookkeeping.
I noticed just in reading it, in the beginning it was more difficult to read because you were just learning about the characters and so having to look who's talking all the time. But as you went further and further in the book, you recognized them as soon as they started talking.
And it's amazing how simple that is actually. Like one of the things is that this character named Hans Vollmann always refers to Willie as the lad. And at one point everybody did. And that when I went through and cleaned that up, you know, the reading mind is so intelligent and so perceptive of those micro details that you could guide a reader pretty easily with just small prompts.
Yeah, that was really fascinating. Yeah.
People tell me the first 20 pages are kind of a litmus test. You might want to throw it across the room. And then some people just leave it at that. Some people, it clicks right away. But essentially, the book by design, is kind of teaching you to read it. And the theory is, if you can go through the training in the first 20, 30 pages, the thing should really open up when you've mastered these kind of tricks of figuring out who's talking before they're identified and the kind of transition between sections and so on. Yeah. That was the plan anyway. So it's set up a little bit, mostly like a play, I guess. There's a chunk of text ranging from one line to nine pages with an attribution after it. And the voices are ghosts, historical accounts, both real and invented. And so it kind of plays out a little bit like a Greek chorus overrunning this graveyard in about a five-hour span.
The ghost voices are usually in one passage together, and then the historical quotes are in separate chapters.
Right.
And I didn't know if all of those historical quotes were real, but some of them are invented.
I think it's about 60-40 real to invented. I have a bibliography somewhere. But yeah, I thought originally I would just use only true verbatim quotes. And then at some point, there would just be an image in my head of a certain event that I couldn't find the text to support, but I know that's how it should be. So then you get into this really interesting kind of crossroads moment where you say, all right, am I writing a historical text or a novel? And of course, the answer is always novel, which means your job is to be thrilling and to be evocative and to kind of overflow the banks of the actual and push into the realm of the eternally true. So at that point, it was kind of an easy decision. I live for the moment when you feel like you're making a big mistake, but you feel a little ornery, like, huh, that's my book. I can do what I like. So in this one, it was when I had thought, I want the history in there. Maybe I just put it in verbatim. And then there was a week or so in my writing shed where I was just typing up Doris Kearns Goodwin and Daniel Mark Epstein and all these people, and then cutting it up with scissors, you know, kind of like William S. Burroughs, and then getting on the floor and arranging them. And the kind of eureka moment when there's a party scene at the beginning, and when I got one of those chapters right, it seemed to kind of like leap into reality, you know, and I thought, oh, that's interesting that I am using my skill, but it's my skill as an editor or curator. You know, I pride myself on being a stylist and being funny. And this was like, okay, you can be that, but now do you have any sort of second skills? And the skill was arranging these curated things. And the goal there was to basically seem innocuous. I don't want you to be able to tell the real ones from the invented ones. So that was kind of a fun new room to go into.
Yeah, I think that really worked well.
There is a kind of a musicality. If I gave you, let's say, 10 quotes about the Battle of Iwo Jima, and I said you could cut them and you could rearrange them, there are certain arrangements that are beautiful and poetic and some that are just blah, and you feel your reading energy drop. So it was kind of fun to use the skills I've hopefully built up by editing myself over the years to make these arrangements of historical nuggets. And, you know, then you have that beautiful realization that it's all about the book. It's, you know, it's all about the emotional draw of the book on the reader. Every decision is made on that basis. So even if you have to sacrifice your ego, you have to put your stylistic pride on hold, as long as the ultimate effect is more emotionally powerful for the reader, you're doing your job.
I wonder if we could have you give people a sense of the historical things.
Yeah, so one of the heartbreaking things about the story was that Willie and Tad, the two sons, had gotten typhoid. So they were sick, maybe 3 out on a scale of 10, and the Lincolns had this big party planned in the White House, and a doctor said, "Ah, go ahead, they'll be okay." They had this big blowout with the Marine band downstairs and hundreds of people.
And this was a true event.
Yes, this is all true.
This actually did happen.
And that night was the night that Willie took the turn for the worse and never recovered. He died a few weeks later. So I think as a parent, of course, you would feel, oh, God, if we hadn't had that party, maybe this wouldn't have happened. So there's a pretty lengthy description of that party, and I'll just drop in. The room was 40 feet long by 30 feet wide and so bright with color it seemed to be full before anyone entered, in The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage by Daniel Mark Epstein. Costly wines and liquors flowed freely, and the immense Japanese punch bowl was filled with 10 gallons of champagne punch. Leach, opposite. Mrs. Lincoln had engaged the esteemed caterer C. Hirt of New York. The cost was rumored to be over $10,000, nor had any detail been overlooked. The chandeliers were garlanded with flowers, the serving tables decorated with rose petals scattered over cut rectangles of mirror. Brunt, opposite. A piggish and excessive display in time of war. Sloane, opposite. Elsa was speechless and only kept squeezing my hand. In such a way, one felt, the ancients must have entertained. What generosity! How kind our dear hosts! In Our Capital in Time of War by Peterson Wicked. In the dining room was a long table with a gigantic looking glass upon it, bearing massive confections of sugar. Most recognizable were Fort Sumter, a warship, a Temple of Liberty, a Chinese pagoda, a Swiss cottage, Coonhard and Coonhard opposite. So it kind of goes on like that.
It gives you an idea of the weaving of it.
Yeah.
I'm Angela Elam with George Saunders, and his most recent book, the novel Lincoln in the Bardo, which won the Man Booker Prize, and it's your first novel.
I mean,
you're such a master of short stories.
Well, thank you.
I have to ask, when somebody comes out with a book of short stories, it seems like the publishing world, the next question they ask is, when are we going to get your novel?
Yeah.
Well, it's been years and years since your first book of short stories.
Yeah.
Did you get that kind of pressure from publishers?
I honestly didn't. I never did.
Really?
My agent is great about it, and I think the story collection did okay. And so I didn't get that pressure. I got a look from myself internally. And then at some point, like when the last book, 10th of December, came out, it did great. And I thought, my thing can be, I don't do novels. And then this book came along, and I, well, maybe I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting, too, is that this book has come out at such a tumultuous time in American history where so many people are unhappy and at odds with each other. And it's good to be reminded of what a horrible time it was back during the Civil War. It was even worse, just to be reminded.
It was funny. When I finished the book, this was before the present political situation, I was kind of revved up about America and just the fact that our history seemed very much alive. And also the racial stuff in the book, really, the research I did made me realize that that has never been fixed. You know, you stole trillions of dollars of labor from a group of people and never made it right. So it was interesting to have those feelings that, wow, history is real and America is a beautiful idea that's never quite done right by itself. And then to see suddenly the reality of our country was responding to that too. So it was intense.
In a way, the timing of this book coming out when it did has worked in your favor, I would imagine.
Yeah, there was one review that said it was exactly the wrong time, but when I went on the road, it was amazing to be in a room of people and everybody was on fire. And I mean, it was political, but it was also existential. There was a feeling, can we talk about something that matters? Can we talk truthfully about this thing that's on our minds? And weirdly, this historical book was kind of a good way to get started, you know, to talk about Lincoln, who of course is so beloved and probably a little bit made into a saint. I mean, I think had he lived, we'd have a more complicated view of him. But to see suddenly in your gaze a president who was really truthful and who really, at a moment of crisis, vanished as an egotistical being. He was very selfless. He would get defeated and accepted defeats. He would even sort of agree to be humiliated or lessened if it would make the cause turn out better. Just a really lovely spiritual person. So just to kind of hold that up and say, this is our model. We do expect this kind of selflessness and this kind of civility and kindness from a president. And yeah.
Yeah. We deserve it.
Yeah, we deserve it. And we need it, actually. I mean, this experiment, this democratic thing we're trying, is not, as we're finding out, it's not on autopilot. And it actually takes a kind of bully pulpit modeling from the top so that everyone will feel good about it. You know, what I felt recently is that it's almost like being part of a dysfunctional family. You see, we're supposed to believe in A, B, C, and D, but from the top, we're seeing constant contradiction of those values. The values that everyday people live by and are punished for not living by, suddenly from the top, you're emanating this kind of upside-down world of contradiction of all the values that all of us on either side of the political spectrum have always embraced, you know, honesty, fidelity, patience, truthfulness. So that's like if your parents are suddenly talking nonsense, it starts to affect your self-esteem a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. There was a passage, it's a very short passage towards the end of this that struck a chord. It's one of the ghosts, Roger Blevins, speaking, and well, I'll let you try to set it up, but they're talking about killing and killing more efficiently.
Right. And what happens is, you know, in this book, the convention is that no living person can be represented unless it's written. And Lincoln never wrote anything about this. So whenever we hear from Lincoln, it's by way of a ghost who's kind of co-occupied the same space as Lincoln and is channeling his mind. So here, two of the ghosts are inside Lincoln towards the end of his night in the graveyard, and he's just trying to think about what should happen next. Actually, what happened for me was I had written this passage preceding this about how all human beings are united in their suffering, and everyone suffers. Nobody gets away without suffering. Therefore, we should all be very gentle and sweet to each other. And then at that point, you know, as a writer, you go, yeah, but he's got to go finish the Civil War. And so this realization hit me, and then in this passage, it hits Lincoln as well. Did the thing merit the killing? On the surface, it was a technicality, mere union, but seen deeper, it was something more. How should men live? How could men live? Now he recalled the boy he had been, hiding from father to read Bunyan, raising rabbits to gain a few coins, standing in town as the gaunt daily parade drawled out the hard talk hunger made, having to reel back when one of those more fortunate passed merrily by in a carriage, feeling strange and odd, smart too, superior, long-legged, always knocking things over, called names, Ape Lincoln, Spider, Apeham, monstrous tall, but also thinking quietly there inside himself that he might someday get something for himself. And then, going out to get it, he had found the way clear. His wit was quick. People liked him for his bumbling and his ferocity of purpose, and the peach orchards and haystacks and young girls and ancient wild meadows drove him nearly mad with their beauty. And strange animals moved in lazy mobs along muddy rivers, rivers crossable only with the aid of some old rowing hermit who spoke a language barely English. And all of that bounty was for everyone to use. Seemingly put here to teach a man to be free, to teach that a man could be free, that any man, any free white man, could come from as low a place as he had. A rutting sound coming from the cane cabin. He had looked in through the open door and seen two pairs of still-socked feet and a baby toddling past, steadying herself by grasping one of the rudder's feet. And even a young fellow who had seen that and lived among those might rise here as high as he was inclined to go. And that against this, the king types who would snatch the apple from your hand and claim to have grown it, even though what they had had come to them intact or been gained unfairly. The nature of that unfairness perhaps being just that they had been born stronger, more clever, more energetic than others, and who, having seized the apple, would eat it so proudly they seemed to think that not only had they grown it, but had invented the very idea of fruit too. And the cost of this lie fell on the hearts of the low. Mr. Belway rushing his children off their Sangamon porch as he and father slumped past with that heavy bag of grain drooping between them. Across the sea, fat kings watched and were gleeful that something begun so well had now gone off the rails, as down south similar kings watched. And if it went off the rails, so went the whole kit, forever. And if someone ever thought to start it up again, well, it would be said, and said truly, the rabble cannot manage itself. Well, the rabble could. The rabble would. He would lead the rabble in managing. The thing would be won.
That was from the end of the novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. I'm talking with George Saunders today here on New Letters on the Air, who's also the author of the award-winning book of short stories, 10th of December, which we have you talking some about that in an earlier New Letters on the Air. You're wonderful in front of an audience, by the way.
Oh, thank you. It's a totally separate job, but I've come to really enjoy it and find it so helpful because you can sit in your room and think, oh, who am I writing to? And then when you get to go out and talk to people, it increases your confidence that what matters to you might matter to them. And that if you go out on a limb like that passage, there are actually people out there who will follow you, you know. So I've really come to love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The public thing is a little bit of an extension of the function of literature, because what you're really doing when you're writing is you're trying to bring up the best part of yourself and then export it. And you do that in the optimism that the reader will do the same. So in public, it's sort of the same. You know, you try to be intelligently optimistic and then maybe leave people feeling the same. It doesn't mean that it's the only truth, but sometimes it's helpful to be buoyed up a little bit.
Yeah, I think it is.
And one of the best ways is to confess that things aren't easy. You know, nothing's easy for anybody, and so we're all in it together.
Yeah, and that's a good thing to remember. It's interesting to me because you gave a commencement address, and it ended up being published, was it in the New York Times?
It was the New York Times website, and then we issued it as a little book.
As too. A book in 2014. Congratulations. By the way, some thoughts on kindness. Mm-hmm.
I had given a similar speech to our daughter's middle school class years before, so my university said, would you give this talk? Oh, sure, I'll just dust off that one. And then I couldn't find it. So 3 days before, I kind of reconstructed it from memory. I could see people dozing off, and you know, and then when it went online, it went viral. And then you become forever more the kindness guy, which is its own kind of curse. But I believe if you define it correctly, which means at every moment you should sort of say, what can I do to let you get all the positive things you want? Not everything you want, but the positive things you want. Then it gets deep. It's not just being nice or sweet or never raising your voice. It has to do with, I think, ultimately with a kind of a shrinking of the self and awareness increase, you know, so that in a given situation, you're kind of more aware of what's actually happening. So it's a lifelong project and beyond, I'm sure.
Yeah. I can't help but think of the metaphor in Lincoln and the Bardo, because you have these ghosts who are trying to get inside Lincoln. Lincoln's trying to cross that line to his son. You know, that is what we need to do in these times of strife, is try to understand the other person instead of going off in our divided areas. Right. To have that compassion for the other person.
It is hard, especially without being a sucker about it. I think a lot of people can go into sort of a new age autopilot where anything that's done is fine. I don't think that's kindness, you know. But this is where I think literature can help us, because literature thrives on specificity, detail, abiding. And it also has a suspension of judgment quality. You know, when you're reading a book, you're reading Jane Austen, you don't actually get to go beat up anybody. You just have to sit there and wait. So the pleasure of that experience is richest when you suspend judgment and let the data come in. So I think that's kind of true in life, too. If we can try our hardest to see the other person, it doesn't mean you have to approve. You could even be mad at them, but you can keep your sensors open. So you're hearing what they say and you're trying to understand it from their point of view. Then at such a time that action is necessary, first, you've delayed action, which is always a good thing. And then you can act actually much more fiercely if you need to. You know, if you're a football coach, and let's say you could have the opportunity of knowing every single player from the inside and the coach. Well, when it's late in the game and you have to do something, that knowledge would really help you to win. You know, so I don't see any downsides in it. But unfortunately, the way the world is set up, I would say this. There's a lot of corporations making a lot of money from agitation through cable news, through social media. These are big corporate concerns, and they're complicated corporate concerns. But basically what they need is for us to be simplistic and agitated. I don't know why that would be a positive thing, but that's the way these deals work. So, you know, when I wrote this book, 4 years in the mind of Lincoln and in Art Mind, it was wonderful, you know. Then I covered the Trump campaign and I had to kind of submerge into cable TV and social media and the shrinking of the mind, you know. I was a different person.
That's right, because you covered the Trump campaign for the New York
Times.
New Yorker. Yeah. That was
But suddenly I was agitated and combative and snippy and suspicious. I mean, it happened very quickly and I could feel it was me letting in all these high-grade corporate toxins that turned me into a lesser version of myself.
So, oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's very fascinating.
And I think it's happening all over with epidemic swiftness, and I think we're so into it that we don't know. I mean, it's an interesting sort of mind control that's not coming from one single point, and also it's coming in a very beautiful package. I had a friend, Michael Hare, the writer of Dispatches, who said, you know, when the fascists come, they're not going to be wearing the jackboots. So this new mind control is actually very seductive and beautiful, and you feel like you're actually a happy participant in it, you know.
Oh, boy.
But on the bright side.
Yeah. Well, I have a dozen other things I wanted to talk to you about, but I only have so much time, so I hope you'll come back sometime.
I will. What a pleasure it was.
Thank you very much.
I enjoyed it.
George Saunders in early 2018 talking about his debut novel, Lincoln and the Bardo. It won the 2018 Audiobook of the Year, so you can hear all those ghosts in action. Find out about George Saunders' early days as a writer in our previous program on our website, newletters.org. If you like what you hear, consider making a donation by clicking the Support New Letters button in the top right-hand corner. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was produced with Ashley Cote and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam. Thanks for listening to New Letters on the Air.